Good morning again. We will be in the book of 1 Kings this morning in the 18th chapter as we're continuing to move through the scriptures and look at some of the things that God is doing from the book of Genesis to the book of Revelation to see the story of scripture as a single unit, though it's, you know, 66 books, several different authors over a couple of different millennia that it was written. It is the story of God's creation and what God is doing in and through creation and in and through His people. And some of those people that we often don't see as maybe we should are the prophets. And sometimes if you've grown up in the church, if you grew up in Sunday school and have heard the stories, it can become easy to romanticize the prophets, especially with episodes like this morning's, which is Elijah on Mount Carmel and his meeting with the prophets of Baal. It's easy to think how great the prophet's job must have been to see things like those. I mean, we teach and we share about the miraculous fire falling from heaven. We possibly discuss the 3 years or 3.5 years of drought that the nation of Israel, the northern tribes, were experiencing. Or we talk about the rain that comes from God's hand unrelentingly at the end of the story. But the prophet's job is far from being romantic. In fact, it's dangerous and often undesirable. I really think that if Ed and Patty Bruce had been writing songs in the 8th and 9th centuries B.C., they would have written a song entitled, "Mamas, Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Prophets," instead of cowboys. Or Cardinal fans. I'm not sure. Teacher and theologian Paul House says, "The Lord shares His word with the prophets, who are then responsible for preaching it and keeping it." And then he goes on and he adds, "The true prophet preaches fidelity to God's word based on God's merciful character." And if we could just stop there, the prophet's job isn't bad. But it says, and he may even claim angelic guidance for doing so, but when you think forward, you think about Jesus and His teachings in the Gospels, and at least two different times, Jesus makes, well, He comments on the harsh treatment of the people of Israel to the prophets. One, He directly confronts them with their treatment and even killing of the prophets, and once He does so in the parable of the wicked tenants. Each time talking about how the people treated the prophets. While we're going to look at Elijah and his prophetic ministry this morning, I want to look at it not with the idea of Elijah confronting the prophets of Baal and the miraculous fire from heaven. But rather, I want us to think about the ministry of Elijah and to think about the ministry of the prophets as a whole. Because there are some things in the prophets, there are some things in the ministry of Elijah, especially in this one circumstance, that are very fitting to the ministry of the prophets as a whole. And we want to understand not just the message of the prophets and the teachings about the prophets, but we want to understand how it impacts us. And there are some correlations between the prophets and what we're called to be as followers of Jesus Christ. You see, I want us to look at Elijah this morning because it helps us to see the ups and the downs, the goods and the bads, the things that look profitable and the things that look difficult for the prophets and their ministries. And so, 1 Kings chapter 18, the writer begins with these words. He says, "After a long time, in the third year, the word of the Lord came to Elijah, 'Go and present yourself to Ahab.'" Now, Ahab is the king of the northern tribes of Israel at this point. He is the one who's leading and ruling those tribes. And God says, "Go to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land." So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. Now, there was a severe famine in Samaria. 3.5 years, it's going to be a severe famine. And then, a few verses later, beginning with the 16th verse, we read about this encounter between Ahab and Elijah. So Obadiah, that is one of the servants of Ahab who has been faithful-ish to Yahweh. He's faithful enough to Baal to save his own skin, but he's been as faithful to Yahweh as he thinks is safe for him. It says, "Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When he saw Elijah, he said to him, 'Is that you, you troubler of Israel?' 'I have not made trouble for Israel,' Elijah replied, 'but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's command, and you have followed the Baals. Now, summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and I will bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table.' So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, 'How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him.' And the people said nothing." It's so much more interesting to look at fire falling from heaven than to consider the ministry of the prophet. The results are glamorous. The ministry is difficult. The results are miraculous. The ministry is scary. You see, it begins with his message to Ahab. God is sending Elijah to meet with Ahab, and as the confrontation between the two begins, it begins with the fact that there has been this drought for 3.5 years. And Ahab knows that Elijah is the one who prophesied the drought. And somehow, he has convinced himself that it is Elijah's fault that the drought is there. Now, we deal with this on a different basis. We deal with people who want to blame everybody else for the problems, for the things that happen in their life. They look at the situation and everybody else is to blame. And so Ahab is no different than the things that we see today, but Ahab wants to blame Elijah. "Elijah, this is your fault. You prophesied that it wouldn't rain." Now, I don't know about you, but have you ever tried to stop the rain? I remember as a kid, we tried all the time. Rain, rain, go away. Come again some other day. You know, how many times did it work? It may have worked once, and that's why we kept doing it, but it doesn't work. Ahab believed, at least in theory, that the Baals and the Asherahs, the gods that his wife encouraged the people to worship, was the god of rain. Baal was the god of the thunderstorms. He's the one who sent the rain to nourish the earth, and the Asherah is the one who gave the abundance so that things would grow. And so Ahab and Elijah have this meeting, and Ahab is trying to blame Elijah for the drought, and Ahab says, look, I'm having none of it. You can blame whoever you want, but here's the truth. Ahab, it begins with you. And he says, it is because of your sins and the sins of your fathers. Now, we could look at all of the sins that Ahab has committed, but the writer of the story, the writer of the book of Kings, leaves us understanding that there is a very narrow scope for the sins that Elijah is speaking of. It begins with his marriage to Jezebel. He's saying to Elijah that part of the problem here is that you have married outside of the family of Israel. You have done what God has said not to do. Now, it began in the southern... Well, it began when they were a unified kingdom with Solomon and all of his wives, including the wives of Pharaoh, or the daughter of Pharaoh, and the women from all of the nations that God had said, you shall not intermarry with them. And it began there. And so for Ahab, one foreign wife doesn't seem that bad, except for the fact that when she came in, Jezebel's purpose was to turn the people from Yahweh to Baal. And it begins very early, and she is working hard to turn the religious tide of Israel farther and farther away from Yahweh and more towards the Baals and the Ashtaroths. That's why you can read that she had 450 prophets of Baal that were eating at her table, and 400 prophets of Asherah that were eating at her table. You notice it wasn't Ahab's table, it was Jezebel's table. Jezebel was bringing this in with her, and she was encouraging the people, and she was inciting them to turn away from Yahweh and turning to the Baals. But here's the thing. One commentator says this. He says Jezebel was not satisfied with the prerogative of private worship. Rather, she has insisted on attempting to promote Baal as a replacement for Yahweh and took steps to silence opposition to her goals. Her successes moved Israel beyond tolerance of high places and syncretism to outright worship of another god. And when the writer says there that she took steps to silence her opposition, well, if you go back and you look at some of what we skipped over in there, you find that Obadiah mentions to Elijah that Jezebel has murdered the prophets of Yahweh. She has, probably not personally, but she has overseen and insisted upon the prophets of Yahweh being put to death because they would continue to keep encouraging the people to turn back to Yahweh. Obadiah says, you know, there are a few. There are a few that I have been hiding and providing for, but she's done a number on the religious, on those that would follow Yahweh. And so you've got the sins of Ahab in his marrying of Jezebel and letting her bring in this Baal and Ashtoreth worship and really promoting it. But Elijah also looks and he says, and also the sins of your fathers. And if you think about the history of Israel, you remember that Solomon was king over all of Israel, the 12 tribes. His son refused to lighten the load of the task of his task force of the workers of Israel, and so the nation splits, and Jeroboam becomes king in the northern tribes of Israel. And as soon as he becomes king, he says, I've got to hold on to my kingdom. And so he makes two golden calves, and he puts one at the southern end of Israel, where people would have to go by it to go down to Jerusalem to worship. And basically saying, you don't need to go to Jerusalem, you can stop here on your way down. And then on the other side of his nation, on the northern side, he put another one of those golden calves, and he said, you know what? It's too much for you to have to go all the way down there to worship. So you can worship at either place. And he began to lead the people away from worshiping Yahweh into worshiping all kinds of different things. They worshiped these golden calves. They worshiped the Baals and the Ashtaroths, and with every generation and every passing king, they only moved farther away from Yahweh and closer to the nations around them. The nations that God had said, I'm driving them out, and you shouldn't join with them. You shouldn't follow their worship, because that's why they are being moved out of the land that they have held, and I am giving it to you. And so Elijah looks at Ahab and says, look, you married Jezebel. You continued in the sins of your fathers. And then he acknowledges the fact that the other prophets have been killed. And this is where it gets scary if your name is Elijah, because in that ensuing material that we didn't read, Obadiah also looks at Elijah and says, I'm not going to go to Ahab and tell him that you're here, because as soon as you do, you'll disappear. And Ahab says, no, or Elijah says, no, I'll be right here. And Obadiah says, yeah, I'm not so sure about that, because Ahab has sent all of the nations around here looking for you and made every king around here promise that he hasn't seen you, because Jezebel has you as enemy number one. You are the one that she wants to get rid of most. Ahab sides with Jezebel, and if your name is Elijah, you have to understand that she wants you dead. He wants you dead. They don't like the message that you have to proclaim. And so Elijah tells Ahab, you're the reason for the drought. And Elijah was called to challenge the gods of Ahab, called to challenge the gods of Jezebel. And when he does, they have this meeting up on Mount Carmel. And the meeting is absolutely spectacular for about 2 minutes at the end. The rest of it's pretty event-filled, but not much happens. But here's the thing. If you stop and just look at it from the point of view of Elijah, Elijah's putting himself in a dangerous situation. You see, Elijah is going to go and he's going to put himself in a place where he is outnumbered. 850 prophets of Baal and Ashtoreth to one prophet of God. Ahab, who is the king and would have had his entourage with him, his bodyguards and his shield bearers and his probably portions of his army, and Elijah. There are the people of Israel who, up to this point, have shown no wherewithal for Yahweh, no concern for worshiping the God who brought them out of Egypt and Elijah. I mean, if you just take the three groups, it's 3-1, but then you start adding up the numbers of those people who would have been a part of that group, and there's all of these thousands, and there's Elijah. Now, think about the most dangerous place you could think of going, and then go there by yourself. Well, that's what Elijah is doing. That's what God is calling Elijah to do. This isn't a romantic situation for Elijah. This is life and death. Or more likely, just death for Elijah. That's the way he has to picture it, except for God. And so Elijah comes and he brings this message to Ahab. Come up to Mount Carmel, and we're going to see which God will come through. Which God will provide the rain that this nation needs. If Baal is really God, he will provide fire from heaven and he will provide rain for the ground, Ahab. Can Baal do it? And Elijah says then, on the other hand, on the other side of things, if Yahweh is God, he will provide fire from heaven and he will provide the rain. But know this, if Yahweh provides the rain, he is God, and Baal is not. And then you have to remember also the fact that if you go back and you study the law that was given, the ways that the people were supposed to deal with certain things, that the false prophet was supposed to be stoned. So here is Elijah coming and saying, okay, I'm outnumbered. This is really not a good place to be. And if God doesn't come through, if Yahweh doesn't come through, they might stone me. Or they might have tried even if Yahweh did come through. And he has to consider that. But you know, sometimes we look at our situation and we think, how could things work out for the good? But I've never been in a place where I was afraid people would stone me for my message. Had some other fears, but never being stoned. But yet this is what Elijah is called to do. This is what the prophets are called to do time and time again, is to bring this undesirable message to the highest person in their nation, the king. And time again, the prophets are put in this position where they are bringing an undesirable message to the king of the nation, and they are severely outnumbered. And nobody else wants to even hear the message they're bringing, but they're called to bring the message. You see, the prophets don't have a romantic job. But it isn't just the message to Ahab that Elijah brings. He brings a similar message to the people of Israel. He brings this message to them, and you know, sometimes the English language is great. But sometimes when the translators of the Scriptures bring us the message into English, we miss some of the message itself because of the way they have to translate things to make sentences flow and to make it so that most people are going to understand the message. And Elijah says to the people, He says, how long? How long will you waver between two opinions? In verse 21. How long will you waver between two opinions? And that makes sense to us. They've got two choices, Yahweh and Baal. How long will you go back and forth between these two messages, between these two opinions? The thing is that the Greek or the Hebrew word would better be translated limp. How long will you limp along between two decisions? But then there's another word in there that probably could be translated different and make it even more emphatic, more exclamatory in its nature, and that is the word opinions very likely would be a word that we would really use for crutches. Where Elijah is saying to them, you are lame. In fact, the same word is used here for waver as is used for Mephibosheth. When it talks about the fact that Mephibosheth was dropped and became lame. It's the same Hebrew word. And so Elijah is saying to them, you guys, you're lame. You're limping along and you're using Baal and you're using Yahweh as crutches. You're not really worshiping and serving either one of them completely. You're kind of using them as crutches and you're wobbling along. You're wavering between two opinions. It's similar to the call that Joshua made in Joshua chapter 24 and verse 15 when he says, choose today whom you will serve. Choose today who you will serve. And Elijah is, in a manner of speaking, asking them who they're going to serve. And at the same time, he's poking fun of them and the fact that they have begun to worship the Baals. And the thing is trying to ride the fence hasn't helped. This is very likely the reason they started to pick up the Baal worship was because, well, they wanted to make sure they had a good harvest. And the gods of Canaan, the Canaanites, who'd been in the land before them, had been worshiping the Baals, and they had good harvest years after years. So if we want to have good harvests, if we want things to turn out well, we need to worship their gods. But we also, maybe we need to keep worshiping Yahweh because, after all, He did bring us up out of Egypt. And so they're trying to ride this fence. They're trying to split their time and split their energy between both Baal and Yahweh. But it doesn't work. Paul House says this. He says, Ahab obliges Elijah by sending for the people and the prophets. They wait to see who will win and who can help them the most. Will it be Baal or Yahweh? The prophet challenges the people to stop limping between two opinions, to decide who is God and then to act upon that decision. Obadiah is a good man trapped between two competing worldviews. Ahab is a king who may be wondering if his ancestral god is more powerful than his wife's deity. The people are non-committal at best. They limp along without conviction, wanting to follow half-heartedly one god and then the other. Which god is going to serve me better today, Baal or Yahweh? Today we'll worship Yahweh because we need what He has to offer. Oh, tomorrow we'll worship Baal because He's going to give us... No, back to... Oh, they can't make up their mind. And riding the fence doesn't work. And so Elijah says to them, you must choose. You must choose Yahweh or Baal. And he gives them a call to commit. But he doesn't put them on the spot. For whatever reason, Elijah says, but okay, you have to choose, but I'm going to give you some time. I'm going to give you some time to think about it. You think about whether you want to worship Baal or Yahweh. And as you do, we're going to have this competition between the gods. And we'll let the prophets of Baal go first, because there's a number of them, and they should get the first opportunity. And so the prophets of Baal do their thing, and Elijah doesn't just give them time through the whole showdown, but he also gives them proof. You want to know which god to worship, Elijah says. Well, I tell you what. We'll see whose god is really God. Because one god will provide fire and rain. And one god will be unsuccessful. And so they go throughout the day, and the prophets of Baal scream and yell and dance and cut themselves and who knows what all else. And Elijah jeers them on and throws down some smack talk that is just unbelievable, and pretty soon it comes Elijah's turn, and Elijah rebuilds the altar of Yahweh. He puts the sacrifice on top of it. He douses everything with a good amount of water, you know, everything he can to make sure that he is unsuccessful. And then he prays. And then he prays. You see, sometimes we're called to share the message. No, that's not true. We're always called to share the message. Sometimes it's personally, like the prophets to the kings. It's this one-on-one with other individuals that we are called to share the gospel of Jesus Christ with. And it may seem uncomfortable, but you know, generally the people that we're sharing the message with aren't going to kill us if they're given the opportunity. Other times we're called to share the message of Jesus Christ, and we're called to do it publicly. But we're called to do it amongst a group of people like Elijah, when everybody is assembled on top of Mount Carmel. And it's no less scary. It's no less confrontational. It's no less sharing the message of truth. But either way, we're called to point people to the truth. We're called to call sin, sin, as Elijah did. We're called to make people aware of the good news of Jesus Christ. We're called to make sure that people know that Yahweh is God. Not the Baals, or today we probably should insert a current god: money, health, pleasure, retirement. Those are not God, and that Elijah is not God. Well, you and I aren't God. We need to make people understand that Yahweh is God, and there is no other. And that's what Elijah does there on the top of Mount Carmel. He makes sure that at the end of the day, it isn't Baal that people recognize as God. It isn't that they look to Yah or to Elijah to worship him, but they understand without a doubt that Yahweh is God. And so he douses the sacrifice with water, and then he prays, and the fire comes down from heaven, and he calls the people to choose. And then, after that part of the story that they never shared with me when I was a kid in Sunday school class, and the people kill the 450 prophets of Baal and the 450 prophets of Asherah on top of Mount Carmel, then he encourages Ahab to go home and to eat before the rain comes, and then the rain. And it isn't just a light spring shower. It isn't a nice gentle rain like we had this morning. No, this is one of those that it rains so hard that if you don't get out of the way, you get swept away. If you don't make it to where you're going before the rain starts to get to the ground, you get stuck and you lose your sandals in the mud. And we may not be able to call down fire from heaven, and we may not be able to call down rain, but we can point people to Jesus Christ nonetheless. And we can tell people the story, how He changed our lives and how He's made an impact, how He's been there in the storms, and how He's been there in the good times. We can tell people what He's done for us and what He can do for them. Because we're called to be like the prophets. And unfortunately, it isn't always romantic, and it isn't always good times and great places that we're called to. It'd be great to be able to say, yeah, you come to Christ and everything is a bowl of cherries with some whipped topping on top. Problem is whoever put the cherries in the pie forgot to take all the pits out, and so you break a tooth, and you might enjoy the pie, but it's not all good all the time. See, sometimes we're called to do the difficult things. We're called to be like the prophets. And while the message we have is good news, Paul says that it's good news to those who are being saved, but to those who are perishing, it's the odor of death. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to be convicted of their sins with the truth. They want to blame everybody else. They don't want to stand up for what's right, because what they're doing seems so much like so much more fun. They don't want to come to Christ because they think if they do, they'll lose everything that's important. But Jesus says, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world but loses his soul? You see, we have a message. We have a message that people may not want to hear, but they need to hear. And we, like the prophets, we may be rejected and we may be turned out, but we're called to preach anyway. This morning we're going to sing one more song together, and I would just encourage you this morning as a follower of Christ to ask for strength as we sing, to ask for wisdom to know where to take the message, and then go. Let's stand together as we sing this morning.